This podcast is going live towards the end of 2020, exactly a century after the events of Bloody Sunday 1920, when a day of bloodshed in Dublin during the War of Independence culminated in the deaths of 14 people who had travelled to Croke Park for a Gaelic football match between Dublin and Tipperary. My guest in this episode is someone who has perhaps done more than anyone else in recent years to bring the events of Bloody Sunday back into the public consciousness in Ireland. It is my privilege to welcome Michael Foley to episode 4 of this series, The Sports Writer's Life. Michael Foley has been a sports writer with the Sunday Times for more than 20 years. He is the author of 3 books on Gaelic games, including The Bloody Field, about the events of that day at Croke Park 100 years ago, and Kings of September, about the famous Offaly Kerry All-Ireland Final of 1982, which won the Boyle Sports Irish Sports Book of the Year Award. If this is your first time checking out the Sports Writer's Life podcast, my name is Shane Breslin, and this 12-part series is brought to you by Magnificent Irrelevance. Magnificent Irrelevance is aiming to become a new publishing venture, bringing readers one standalone and standout piece of soul-searching sports writing every week. You can find out more about Magnificent Irrelevance and sign up for regular updates in the journey towards making it a reality by visiting magnificentirrelevance.com. So let's get into it. This is episode 4 of The Sports Writer's Life with award-winning journalist and author from the Sunday Times, Michael Foley. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Shane. Great to be here.
So the format is 3 questions, and if we go a couple of different directions just to elaborate on any of those, we might do that. But the first question, cast your mind back a number of years. How did you first get into sports writing?
Whoa. It's that kind of wibbly wobbly effect I have on movies. We go back into time. I was in college. I did journalism in college in DIT in Angel Street. So I started there in the mid 90s, 95. And at the time, there was the odd bit of work going around, and we were very lucky. People would come in from various newspapers and radio, TV and stuff, and kind of, they'd kind of throw stuff at us, or at least encourage us to apply for things, you know. So I had done a little bit of work. I'd done a little bit of work with Airtel. Very little bit of work. It was fairly disastrous now. But anyway, I did a couple of nights with them. And then I just remember there was a guy lecturing us at the time, Owen Corry was his name, and Owen was involved with a magazine called Highball, which was the GA's official publication at the time. And he asked a few of us in the class who were interested in sports journalism, would we come in and give us a shot, like to do a bit. So my first bit in print was an article about the 1997 presidential election for a Welsh language newspaper. So I wrote it in English, and a mate of mine who was Welsh, who had asked me to do it, translated it for his newspaper. So I started out in politics, really. So anyway, Highball was probably the first to start. And then the Sunday Tribune were advertising for sub-editors in spring of 98. And one of the girls in the class actually had cut it out of the newspaper, and she was handing it across to one of the lads and in the canteen. And I said to your man, Arthur, are you going to apply for that, or what are you going to do? And he was kind of, I don't know. I said, I might apply for it. He said, I'll walk away. So anyway, I applied for it. I think I had already sent something into them. I'd done a radio documentary for a project for college, and it was based on Cláiste Owen and Stillorgan, who had got to an All-Ireland colleges, were a very small school at the time. I went for the subs job, had an interview. Brian Carey was the sports editor at the time. He's now business editor in the Sunday Times, and Paul Howard was there. And I remember Brian and Paul meeting me and talked about the sub-editing job. And then in classic Tribune style at the time, kind of said, well, there's league matches on this weekend. No, what would you do if you... If we asked you to write something? So Cork were playing Tip in a league hurling game. So I said, I'd probably suggest Dermot O'Sullivan or one of those, because they're just starting out and he's a young fella, and he looks like he's going to be the fullback for Cork for a long time if it all goes well for him. I said, right, 800 words on that, please, for Sunday. So I was like, okay. So that was it. So that was springtime 98, and I stayed with them through the summer, and I went back to college to finish off, and I was freelancing really for them then for the next 18 months or so.
Excellent. And from then, it seems like you've been with the Sunday Times for a long time. So how long have you been with the Sunday Times now?
Oh God, about three lifetimes. I've been there. Yeah, well, after the, well, I was with the Trib until January 2000, and I jumped across in January 2000. And like that time, the Sunday Times was only in Ireland, I think, 5 years at that stage. But, and coming from Cork, our papers at home would have been the Examiner during the week, and then on the Sunday, you'd get the Sunday Independent, the Sunday World, the News of the World, and the Press, the Sunday Press, when it was going. We've got a lot of newspapers, like as a lot of houses did that time. So the Sunday Times meant nothing to me until I went to Dublin, and the lads I was sharing the flat with used to get the Sunday Times all the time then, because it was massive. And I started reading it and looking at it, and it just looked fantastic. And like, it was my ambition at the time was, you know, and I didn't expect it to happen in 2000, but like down the years, I always thought, well, if I'm good enough to get over to the Sunday Times, that's my ambition in print journalism, to work for the Sunday Times. But I just got very, very, very lucky. There was a few moves, a couple of lads moved in the Sunday Times, and there was a space, and just the way things fell, I think I was part, I was 23, I think, at the time. So I was kind of part of a very short-lived youth policy, I think, at the Sunday Times, that said, we'll bring this fella in now, we'll see what we can make of him. So yeah, I went in and suddenly I ended up just writing about Gaelic football mainly. There was nothing planned or anything. I was delighted to do it. I'm very happy to be doing it, but I never planned really to be in GA journalism per se as my bread and butter. That was never really the plan, but it just, at that time, a lot of lads coming out of college and a lot of guys getting into sports journalism. It wasn't rugby either. Rugby was nowhere. Guys wanted to cover soccer. And very few people, there was a gap in GA. There was a lot of gaps in GA journalism at that time for young lads if they wanted to get into it. So I said, may as well be, go for it. Like, you know, that's where the jobs are. Let's go.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember because I was like you say about the houses and the relationship with newspapers. My mother, going back to the, you know, early mid 90s, would have bought three or four newspapers on the weekend, on the Sunday. I started buying the Sunday Times round about the late 90s. I think it was probably David Walsh and a couple of other great sports writers that were in there at the time, and just the width and breadth of the paper. It was like, it was such an impressive, like, it was impressive even to carry the Sunday Times. It was so big.
It was a funny time for them, because like when they started in Ireland, they had Dennis Walsh came across from the Tribune in 96. So they had Dennis, they had David Walsh. Paul Kimmage came a good bit later beyond that, after that. But they had Kimmage and Dennis. They got Babs Keating and they got Jack O'Shea as their GA columnists. Tom English was their rugby writer. Tom, who's now with the BBC. Tom's a sports editor, actually, the Sunday Times when I started in 2000. And his brother Alan then had been the original sports editor, went and came back again. So we kind of worked with the both of them. They were fantastic. But yeah, it was a very, and the funny thing about it is, we often hear now, I know I'm going down a rabbit hole here now, but we'd often hear about, you know, the Sunday Times long reads, you know, these 3,000, 4,000 word features. Well, back in the late 90s, they were doing, the most they would have got was 1,300 words. It was quite like it is now. The Sunday Times has gone back again to the kind of the shorter reads. They don't do the big, massive long reads as much as they used to. But that's how they started out in Ireland and the UK as well. It was the same in the UK. They didn't do the big long reads, but they had this roster of stars. You know, Hugh McIlvany was there as well over in the UK. Joe Lovejoy doing soccer. Stephen Jones was there doing rugby. It was just, and they were all crammed into this small space. And so going over there, like, I can remember going over and just thinking, it immediately obliges you to up your game, whatever that means, or however high you can get, because your piece is going to be sitting opposite David Walsh, so you're not expecting to be as good as Dennis or David Walsh or anything like that. Dave Hennigan was there doing soccer, Irish soccer that time. You're not expecting to be as good as them, but you can't let yourself down. You can't embarrass yourself. Like, it's something that doesn't happen now, but I can very, very vividly remember having very, very long conversations on Friday nights and Saturday mornings with Paul Rowan, actually, who's the Irish soccer correspondent now, and he was a brilliant, brilliant sub-editor at the time, going through my stuff, trying to bring it up to scratch. And it was really tough, like really tough, and very demoralizing at times. But it was great, because I don't know, do you get that attention now in newspapers, guys literally walking through every sentence of your piece and going, this works, this doesn't work, we're going to have to, you know, that kind of rigor. Yeah. But I mean, it stood me in whatever state it stood me in anyway, it didn't do me any harm.
Absolutely. And you say, like, line by line, obviously structural kind of setup as well of pieces, like everything was kind of up for discussion.
I remember doing a piece 4 years later, or 2 years after I started. So 2000, I was there. Armagh won the All-Ireland in September 2002. And Alan English was the sports editor at this stage. And Alan sent me up to Armagh to cover the homecoming on the Monday morning after they won the All-Ireland. So we were all in lovely shape going up, I can tell you, to Armagh. But I went up and I spent whatever many, couple of days up there. Came back and it was to be like a 3,000 worder. Now it was starting to expand at this stage. But I remember writing it and I sent it to Alan and he sent it back with lots of encouragement. But basically, when you read between the lines, he was asking me to turn it upside down. So the second half needed to be first and the first half needed to be second. And I flipped it around and I could see straight away when I flipped it around, I could see the benefit and I could see his thinking and you know, so things like that. So, I mean, literally, I mean, poor Paul, like, he'd be so patient and yet so, it was such an amount of work to get the stuff up to scratch in those first 2 or 3 years. And I mean, look, it's ongoing. I mean, I've worked with Dennis Walsh for 20 years and Dennis would have been one of the main, another reason why I wanted to go and work with the Sunday Times, because in 2000 he was, and still is, like, you know, one of the best sports writers in the country. And Dennis always makes the point, like, you know, you're starting again. I mean, we work a Tuesday to Saturday week. So the paper comes out on a Sunday and whatever, you know, you wouldn't be getting loads of feedback, don't get me wrong now, but I mean, whatever you've done on Sunday, it kind of means nothing. You start from scratch on Tuesday, the same as you did any other stage in your career. So you're constantly have that rigor on yourself and you're constantly kind of checking yourself and trying to be better and trying to make the best of whatever you have in a given week and, you know, not step back. And that culture has been there for 20 years. You know, I've lived that culture for 20 years. For better or worse, I'm not saying that you live up to it all the time. And maybe we don't live up to it enough, but it's certainly that's how we were taught, you know.
Bring us up to today. And like, so you've been in the Sunday Times, as I say, like it's a little over 20 years now at this stage. What's your current, and obviously as we're recording this, we're still sort of in a kind of a limbo with coronavirus. What is your kind of day-to-day or week-to-week in the Sunday Times now?
Technically speaking, ordinarily, your standard week is Tuesday to Saturday. So my Sunday is my Saturday and my Monday is my Sunday, if that makes sense. In the summertime, that goes out the window. So you're basically working, you're at a game anyway on a Sunday, even if you're not reporting on it, you're somewhere. And then on a Monday, you'd often be organizing and arranging things. So it kind of very quickly becomes a 7-day week when certainly the GA season kicks off. Excuse me. And like, you know, it depends what's going on. I mean, if there's a major sporting event is going on and you get pulled into it, that's what happens. At the moment in lockdown, you really, the great challenge with the COVID lockdown, particularly for a Sunday newspaper, is trying to weave between what the daily media has been doing. And, you know, again, we're in a scenario now where it's not just print media, you're looking at radio, you're looking at online, you're looking at so many different media outlets. And I mean, to say that the media has done a good job is an understatement over the last few months, just from a sports point of view, just in terms of keeping the content going. Some places have done a lot of nostalgia and there's an audience for that. Other places have done terrific work just finding stories and trying to illustrate the reality of the lockdown for people and convey stories that maybe we mightn't have heard as well. And I include local media in that. Like, it's been amazing. So I'm sitting here like on a Tuesday. I mean, I think it was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, I think I had about 5 ideas fall down in 48 hours because they'd already appeared in the papers during the week. So like a lot of the time, it's you're on the phone just trying to generate stuff. You're surfing, just trying to find a few things.
You brought up, or you mentioned the kind of the move in the Sunday Times away from where it was, like, you know, the shorter pieces back 20 years ago or so, and then there was a period where there was at least an opportunity or openings for much longer, more in-depth pieces, and that has kind of moved back away from it again. Do you miss the longer pieces, or what was your relationship with those like?
Oh yeah, like I mean, you'd always like to have a little bit more room. You know, we all have egos. We all think we have more to say than we actually do. But no, like I mean, it was a great outlet. We had a slot called the Big Interview back that time, and you know, there was always requests that time. Do you have anybody Irish that we could use in this? You know, any good GA players or rugby players or whatever to be at that time, and we got some great. We had some great runs with that, and again, it was a different time. I mean, the Sunday Times that time was 32 pages of a sports section. So, like in the late 90s, it was a very small sports section. I think, if my memory serves me right, I think it shared it with the motoring section. So, I mean, that's you know, it was very small. And then in the noughties, when sales started to improve and a lot of people were buying newspapers, and the Sunday Times was going through a really good time, it went up to 32 pages. So there was a lot of room. So that was good. Recession comes in then in the early part of this decade, and it squeezes down again. And also, there's a move to digital as well. And I think the sense is that smaller pieces, basically, people are more inclined. More people will read shorter pieces. That's not to say that there's not a place for long form. I do think there's very much a place for long form, but it's a bit more nuanced. And I think at a time when newspapers are sort of they're betwixt and between in terms of chasing print sales and trying to establish themselves as a digital product. It's very hard to get that balance right. And I mean, you'll find some fantastic long form stuff in Irish journalism and UK journalism as well. And there are still, I mean, sometimes I still occasionally kick the boat out and do 2,000 worder or something like that, depending on what the thing is. But at the moment, the kind of the trend is towards your sort of 1,200 to 1,400 words being your max, and work within those parameters. And you know, look, it's compared to the long form, it's a different sort of discipline. It's funny, we'd say sometimes when we get given a bit extra wordage up beyond the 14 or 15, you'd be going, "Whew, you got to get your stamina back up again to do this." Like, you know, because you get used to a different form, but you can still, I think, you can still say plenty. You can still say plenty in a shorter space. But definitely, sometimes there are topics where you'd love to have a bit more space just to give them a bit more room to breathe. But you're looking, just get on with it, you know?
Yeah. Look into the future. You mentioned earlier on about the kind of the move or the trend towards maybe less rigor or less room for rigor as there was maybe 20 years ago or so. What trends do you see in terms of your own role or in the wider sports writing industry, if you could call it that? And where do you see things going?
Well, I think it's hard to know. I kind of, to be honest with you, gave up trying to predict this stuff a while back, because I was kind of looking at, you know, what are people reading and what kind of stuff are they interested in reading? And I kind of just gave up. I kind of went, you know what? I don't even know. I'm not even sure I know what people want anymore. And, you know, when you're at it a while, you kind of do tend to hope to think that you might have some notion what people want to read, but it's hard to know. Like, I mean, the thing that's always struck me about it over the last 10 years is the sort of, it's been the gutting of the internal works of a newspaper. So, I mean, it was described to me very well by a sports editor some years ago. He was talking about cutbacks in the newspaper and they were losing sub-editors and people who worked on production. And he said, like, the sports section now, he said, it's a little bit like running a conveyor belt in a car factory. So, you know, there's less people putting bolts and bits and pieces into it, but you do get a car at the end of it. Like, you get something that looks like a car, looks like a newspaper. But if you open the bonnet and look closer into it, you'll see where all the bits are missing. You'll see there's more errors, there's more glitches. There's just less, I'm not going to say there's less rigor, because I'm no doubt that the guys that are working on newspapers, I know they are, giving it 110% to get the best product out they can. But it's inevitable when you only have, when you have less eyes on a thing, that there's going to more stuff, you know, slip through. So I think from that side of things, that's a worry, that, you know, standards or the quality of the product will inevitably dip, and probably have inevitably dip when guys are put under more pressure to do the work of two, three fellas, you know. In terms of digital, it's the way of the future. There's still a place for print sales, but they're looking towards digital now, and how you sell that as a product is is the big question. I never understood why newspapers give away content for free. It just doesn't make sense to me. And it's, I mean, I'll put it this way. If you can train people to pay extra to watch soccer on their TV, having had it for 10, 15 years before that for free, through BBC and ITV and whatever, you can train them. You can encourage, you can entice people to pay for your journalism content. And you see it, I think, with some of the big stories, not sports stories necessarily, but just some of the big stories over the last 2 or 3 years that have occurred. There's been a lot of praise for good journalism, and a slow realization that if you're not going to pay for this, it's not going to exist. And I think that's important. That's an important thing to get their heads around. I mean, I think whatever form a newspaper takes, whether it's an online piece of journalism or a print piece of journalism or an audio or a visual piece of journalism, you're still going to need gatekeepers, and you're still going to need trained, qualified people to sift through spin, to sift through lies, to sift through various different angles that people in power will want to take you down, and see it for what it is and deliver to the public something that's worthwhile and that guides them through a story. I've always believed, all right, that like whatever format we end up with, we'll still need journalists and we'll still need that gatekeeping aspect that's provided by trained, qualified people who are experienced enough to look out for this stuff and know how to handle information and distill it in a way that gets the proper meaning and the proper interpretation across to people.
It's been fantastic talking to you, Michael. And before we wrap up, I'd like to invite you to, if there are pieces that come to mind, one of your own possibly that you're proud of, and maybe one from somebody else that you're in some way maybe envious of.
Oh, there's loads of ones that I'm envious of. I could write a book about the ones I'm envious of. Gosh, and I'm conscious now of I'll probably think of about 10 of them when I finish talking, you know. But I mean, in terms of one that I've always admired, Dennis Walsh did a piece with the three Clare hurlers from Clare Castle. So it was Fergie Toohey, Anthony Daly, and Gerard Loughlin before the 97 All Ireland hurling final. And it was just, you know, bringing the three lads together on the eve of another massive day for them, and kind of telling the story of where they were from and all that. And it kind of, that was 1997. And for me, that kind of pulled together an awful lot of things about where Irish sports journalism was going at the time. It was more about the people and the place and telling a big story in a small way, or, you know, telling the story through the individuals and reaching a level rather than just giving them the bare bones, the bare stats of something, you know. And there was a lot of craft in it, and there was an awful lot of writing in it, and it was just a fantastic piece of work. And that's 23 years ago, whatever it is, and it still stands up to scrutiny. For myself, I honestly don't know.
Even one that springs to mind that you kind of, that you enjoyed, or something that you really that stands out in the memory.
I remember there's a couple, all right, I suppose. I remember interviewing Colm Cooper before the 2007 All Ireland final, and it was against Cork, and unfortunately Gooch played very, very well that day and absolutely destroyed Cork. But I enjoyed that. And that there was actually a couple, yeah, that one won an award. There was a guy, I remember going over to interview a fella in London, got to a Connacht final in 2013, and I was due to meet a couple of guys, certainly one other chap from London. I went over on a day trip, but the first guy just didn't answer his phone, so I was kind of stranded in London. So I had made an arrangement to meet a chap called Pronshius Redican, who was a guy from Leitrim who had lived in London for 50 years, 60 years at that stage. But it ended up that because I'd hoped to do a kind of a piece on the community, the football community. But anyway, I ended up going over to Pronshius, and it ended up that Pronshius was the only one I ended up speaking to. But he was fantastic. He was a tailor, and he worked like on Carnaby Street in the 60s. And he just had this amazing story to tell about, you know, minding footballers on the one hand, and then this other life you know, making suits for George Best and the Beatles and all this other stuff. And they were lovely people. He was in his 80s, and his wife was a lovely lady as well. And they were still washing the club jerseys out the back, and he had Shannon Side on the radio, on the digital radio. So maybe that one. I mean, I don't know. I don't tend to... you just tend to move on, you know. That's kind of what's good and what's bad is probably for other people to say. But those two probably stick out just when you mention them now in my head. Eamon McGee. I like Eamon McGee from Donegal. Eamon's always very good with his time and his thoughts. We did one recently. The last time we chatted was about a friend of his who died in a car crash. There was a car crash up there where four lads died just around Christmas time. And he was very, very kind and honest and giving with his thoughts. Nice is the wrong word, but it was very impactful on me. You know, you learn a lot. What I find with these things is if you get into a conversation, like any conversation, Shane, if you get into a good conversation with someone, you learn a lot from them, and you can take away an awful lot more than just a good article from it, you know.
Michael, it's been a pleasure.
Yeah, no problem.
Shane here again, really briefly. Thank you for listening to this episode of The Sports Writer's Life. If you enjoyed the show, please do one or all, if you like, of these three things. First of all, a review would be amazing. Find the show on Apple Podcasts and leave a review, or whatever system you use. If there is a review functionality, go ahead and post a review. That helps to get this show to more listeners around the world. If you don't know where to go, I will post a link to the Apple Podcast review system in the show notes of this episode. Secondly, please do subscribe to The Sports Writer's Life to make sure that all 12 of these episodes appear in your podcast player as they go live in the coming weeks. And thirdly, head on over to magnificentirrelevance.com to hear more about the plans for this new publication, which aims to bring readers one standalone and standout piece of soul-searching sports writing each week. Thanks again for being here. This is Shane Breslin signing off, and I'll be back to you soon with the next episode of The Sports Writer's Life.